to be gained from that chair. It was all another lie that gave me as much terror as it seemed to give him hope. His voice took on a pleading tone.
I need someone to believe in me wholeheartedly, Adrina. I need from you the trust that she gave me. That's the only gift I want you to recover. Her gift for having faith in me, in yourself. Your mother loves me, I know that. But she doesn't believe in me. Now that my first Adrina is gone, I'm depending on you to give me what once made me feel clean and wonderful. Need me as she needed me. Trust me as she trusted me. For when you expect only the best, that's what you will get.
That wasn't true. I yanked away from his embrace. No, Papa. If she expected only the best and was so trusting of you, why did she go into the woods against your orders? Was she expecting the best the day she was found dead under the golden rain tree?
Who told you that?
He asked sharply. I don't know, I cried, unsettled to hear my own words. I didn't even know what a golden rain tree was. His face bowed down into my hair as his hand gripped my shoulder so hard it hurt. When he finally found something he could say, he sounded miles and miles away, like the warm place those geese were going to.
In some ways, you're right. Perhaps your mother and I should have given her more explicit warnings. As it was, we were embarrassed and didn't tell our first Adrina enough. But none of it was her fault.
None of what, Papa?
Dinner time, sang out Mama, as if she'd been listening and knew exactly when to interrupt our conversation.
My aunt was already at the round table in the family dining room, glowering as Papa carried Vera into the room. Vera glowered back. The only time my aunt seemed to like her daughter was when she was out of sight. When Papa was around, she could be so cruel to Vera, even I winced. She wasn't as cruel to me. Mostly, she treated me with indifference, unless I somehow managed to irritate her, which was often. Papa hugged Vera before he went to sit at the head of the table.
Feeling better, honey?
Yes, Papa, she said with a bright smile. I feel fine now. The minute she said that, Papa beamed a broad smile my way. He gave me a conspiratorial wink that I'm sure Vera saw. She dropped her eyes and stared down at her plate, refusing to pick up her fork and eat. I'm not hungry, she said when my mother tried to coax her.
Eat now, ordered Aunt Elsbeth, or you won't eat anything until breakfast.
Damien, you should have known better than to give the children candy before dinner.
Ellie, you give me a pain in a certain part of my anatomy I won't mention in front of my daughter. Vera will not die of malnutrition. Tomorrow she'll stuff herself as she stuffed herself before her fall.
He reached to squeeze Vera's pale, long fingers.
Go on, darling. Eat. Show your mother you can hold twice as much as she can.
Vera began to cry. How awful of Papa to be so cruel. After dinner, just like Mama did, I ran upstairs, threw myself on my bed, and really bawled. I wanted a simple life with firm ground beneath my feet. All I had was quicksand. I wanted parents who were honest, consistent from day to day, not so changeable I couldn't depend on their love to last for longer than a few minutes. An hour later, the corridor resounded with Papa's heavy tread. He didn't bother to knock, just threw open the door so hard the latch banged into the plastered wall and made another nick. There was a key in the lock which I never dared to use, fearful he would kick my door down if I did. Papa strode into my room wearing a new suit he'd changed into since dinner time, telling me he and Mama were going out. He'd showered and shaved again, and his hair fell in soft waves, perfectly molded to his skull. He sat on my bed, caught my hand in his, allowing me to see his square, large nails that were buffed so much they shone. Minutes passed as he just sat there, holding my hand, which felt lost in the hugeness of his. The night birds in the trees outside my bedroom window twittered sleepily. The little clock on my night table said 12 o'clock, but it wasn't the real time. I knew he and Mama wouldn't go out at midnight. I heard a boat whistle in the distance, a ship putting out to sea.
Well,
he said at long last,
what have I done this time to wound your fragile ego?
You don't have to be nice to Vera one minute and nasty to her the next. And I didn't push Vera down the steps. My voice sounded faltering, and this was certainly not the kind of confident speech that would make anyone believe me.
I know you didn't push her,
he said somewhat impatiently.
You didn't have to tell me you didn't. Adrina, never confess to a crime until you are accused.
In the gloomy dimness, his dark ebony eyes glittered. He frightened me.
Your mother and I are going to spend the evening with friends in the city. You don't have to rock in the chair tonight. Just be a good girl and fall into dreamless sleep.
Did he think I could control my dreams? How old am I, Papa? The rocking chair has never told me that. He'd left my bed to head for the door, and in the open doorway he paused to glance back at me. The hall gas lamps shimmered on his thick, dark hair.
You are 7, soon to be 8.
How soon to be 8?
Soon enough.
He came back and sat down.
How old do you want to be?
He asked. Only as old as I'm supposed to be.
You'd make a good lawyer, Adrina. You never give me a straight answer.
Neither did he. I was catching his habits. Papa, tell me again why I can't remember exactly what I did last year and the year before. He sighed heavily, as he always did when I asked too many questions.
My sweetheart, how many times do I have to tell you? You are a special kind of girl with talents so extraordinary that you don't realize the passing of time. You walk alone in your own space.
I already knew that. I don't like my own space, Papa. It's lonely where I walk. I want to go to school like Vera does. I want to ride on that yellow school bus. I want friends to play with. And I can't remember ever having a birthday party.
Can you remember Vera's birthday parties?
No.
That's because we don't celebrate birthdays in this house. It's much healthier to forget about time and live as if there were no clocks and no calendars. That way, you never grow old.
His story was so much like Mama's. Too much. Time did matter. Birthdays, too. Both mattered more than he said. He said goodnight and closed the door, leaving me to lie on my bed and wonder. One night, screams woke me up. My screams. I was sitting up, clawing at the sheet, covering myself up to my chin. In the long corridor, I heard the pounding of Papa's bare feet as he came running. On the side of my bed, he perched to hold me in his arms, smoothing my tousled hair, hushing my piercing cries, telling me again and again that everything was all right. Nothing could harm me here. Soon, I fell asleep, safe in his arms. Morning light woke me, and Papa was in the doorway, smiling broadly, almost as if he'd never left me alone.
Sunday morning, love. Time to rise and shine. Put on your Sunday clothes and we'll be off.
I stared at him, sleepy-eyed and disoriented. Was it only last week that Vera broke her leg? Or was it much, much longer? It was a question I put to Papa.
Darling, you see what I mean? It's December now. In 5 days it will be Christmas. Don't tell me you've forgotten.
But I had. Time had such agility when it came to fleeting past me. Oh, God. What Vera said about me had to be true. I was vacant-headed, forgetful, perhaps brainless. Papa? I called out nervously before he closed the door so I could dress for church. Why do you and Mama let everyone in church believe Vera is your daughter and not Aunt Elspeth's?
We don't have time for that kind of discussion now, Adrina. Besides, I've told you many times before how your aunt went away for almost 2 years and came back with a 1-year-old daughter. Of course, she was expecting to marry Vera's father. We couldn't let everyone know a white fern had given birth out of wedlock. Is it such a crime to pass Vera off as our own and save your aunt from disgrace? This isn't New York City, Adrina. We live in the Bible Belt, where good Christians are supposed to abide by the rules of the Lord.
Vera belonged to some nameless man, and my father was generous and only doing the decent thing, and I was his one and only living daughter. Vera liked to pretend he was her father, but he wasn't. I'm so glad I'm your only daughter, who's alive. He stared at me blankly for a moment, his full lips thinning. I'd been told many a time that eyes were the windows of the soul, so I ignored his lips as I studied his dark, shuttered eyes. Something hard and suspicious rested in them.
Your mother hasn't said any differently, has she?
No, Papa, but Vera has. Suddenly, he laughed and hugged me so tight against his chest that my ribs ached afterwards.
What difference does it make what Vera says? Of course she wants me for her father. After all, I'm the only father she's ever known. And if all others think Vera is your mother's child, let them think what they will. There isn't a family anywhere without skeletons in its closets. Our skeletons are no worse than anyone else's. Besides, wouldn't the world be a boring place if everyone knew all there was to know about everyone? Mystery is the spice of life. That's what keeps people living on and on, hoping to uncover all the secrets they can.
I thought the world would be a better place without all the skeletons and mysteries. My world would be a perfect place if only everyone in my home knew how to be honest. The Rocking Chair. Vera came to my room that night soon after I'd climbed into bed, determined to have only happy thoughts before sleeping, hoping they'd lead to happy dreams. Hobbling with considerable skill on the crutches she'd grown accustomed to, she managed to carry things in a book bag she'd slung over her shoulder. Only this book bag was different from any I'd seen before. "Here," she said, tossing me the bag on the bed.
"Educate yourself. Those two women in the kitchen will never teach you what I will."
I felt a little skeptical, but happy nevertheless that she was interested in my education. I knew there were many things I was missing by not going to school. Shaking the bag's contents onto my bed, dozens of photographs cut from magazines fell to my bed in a ragged clump. I couldn't believe my eyes when I picked them up and started to separate them, staring all the time at pictures that showed naked men and women in lewd, weird embraces. The hateful things clung to my fingers, so tacky I plucked them free from one hand, only to find them sticking to the other. Then, to my consternation, I heard the heavy tread of Papa's feet as he came toward my room. Vera had done this on purpose. She knew Papa came to my room each night around this time. "I'm going," said Vera with a delighted grin. She hobbled toward the door of the bedroom that adjoined mine, planning to escape Papa.
"Don't you dare tell him I was here if you know what's good for you."
But on her crutches, she couldn't move fast enough. Papa threw open the door and glared at the two of us.
"What's going on in here?"
he asked. With the guilty evidence stuck to my fingers, I hesitated and thus gave Vera the chance to dump all the crime in my lap. I found that book bag in a closet, and since it was monogrammed with her initials, I thought this Adrina should have it. Scowling darkly, Papa came to me and tore the clippings from my fingers. He took one glance and howled in rage. Then, whirling around, he thrust out his arm and sent Vera reeling to the floor, and she was already broken enough. Like someone demented and dying, Vera screamed out her rage.
"It's hers! Why are you hitting me?"
Papa picked her up and held her as if she were some stiff-legged puppy from the gutter. He held her over my bed.
"Now pick them up,"
he ordered harshly.
"My first Adrina would no more look at that filth than she'd tar and feather you, which I'll do if you don't stop tormenting me. Now you have to eat them,"
he added, when she had them in her nervous, pale hand. I thought he was joking. So did she.
"I'm going to scream for my mother," threatened Vera. "I'm hurt. I've got broken bones. I could die. You let me go, or tomorrow I'll go to the police and tell them you abuse me."
"Eat them,"
he bellowed.
"You've coated them with glue. They shouldn't taste worse than your mother's cooking."
"Pa, Pa," she wailed. "Don't make me eat paper and glue."
Snorting in disgust, he carried her out of the room. A few seconds later, I heard her screaming as he applied his belt to her bare skin. I didn't truly know if he used his belt when she was naked, but 10 to 1 she'd tell me he did. Vera could scream if a fly lit on her arm, so how could I know unless I got up and found out for myself?
I never did because, for some reason, I was afraid what she said might be true. Minutes passed while my heart raced. Eventually, Vera's screams ebbed away, but still Papa didn't come. Somewhere downstairs, a clock chimed 10 times, but that meant little. Every bone in my body ached. Every muscle was tensed. I knew I'd have to sit in the rocking chair again tonight. Finally, when I felt I could bear the suspense no longer, knowing I'd never fall asleep until I did what he'd forced me to do, I heard a door close, and soon, heavy footfalls sounded in the corridor. Papa's tread was even, heavy, squeaking the old sagging floorboards. Softly, he eased open my bedroom door and stepped inside. Quietly, he closed the door behind him. He loomed up in the night like some huge monster, casting a long shadow in the dimness of my moonlit room.
"So?"
he drawled in his most beguiling southern voice, cultivated over the years from his clipped Yankee delivery.
"Now you've taken to looking at obscene photographs that will dirty your mind. That shames me, Adrina. Really shames me."
"Not me, Papa," I said. "Vera brought them in here, but don't hit her again, please. You could break her other arm and leg, or maybe her neck. You shouldn't whip her when she's hurt."
"I don't whip her,"
he said harshly.
"I just scolded her, and she started screaming that I didn't love her. God, how can anyone love someone who makes so much trouble? Even if Vera brought in those nasty pictures and gave them to you, you didn't have to look, did you?"
"Didn't I?"
"I thought better of you than that. Don't let Vera destroy the best that's in you."
"Why are boys dangerous for me and not for Vera, Papa?"
"Some girls are born to be what Vera is. Boys can sniff them out from miles away. That's why I don't bother about her. It wouldn't do any good. It's you I care about because it's you I love. I used to be a boy, and I know how boys think. I'm sorry to say most boys cannot be trusted. That's why you have to stay out of the woods and close to home and out of school, too. It's dangerous for a beautiful, sensitive girl like you. It's the kind of woman you'll grow up to be that will be the salvation of mankind. That's why I struggle to save you and protect you from contamination."
But, Papa...
"Don't protest. Just accept the fact that parents worry. Adults are far wiser about the world, especially wise about their own flesh and blood. We know you are ultra-sensitive. We want to spare you those unnecessary pains. We love you. We want to see you grow up healthy and happy. That's all."
He came to sit on the edge of my bed as I lay on my back, frozen and trying not to breathe. Tightly, I squeezed my eyelids together. My lids parted a bit to peek and see if he believed I'd fallen asleep. So deeply asleep, I might even be dead. And maybe in death I'd gain the nobility of the first and best Adrina and would never have to sit in her chair again. But he leaned closer. I seized hold of the sheet and pulled it up high under my chin. Papa's iron-like hands closed down on my shoulders. His strong fingers digging into my tender skin made my eyes pop wide open and clash with his. Our gazes locked, and in a silent duel of wills, we fought until my mind went vague, out of focus, and he was the winner again.
"Now, now,"
he soothed, beginning to stroke my hair.
"It's not so bad, is it? You've done it before, and you can do it again. I know sooner or later you will catch the gift, if you are patient and keep trying. You can help me, Adrina."
But, I stammered, wanting to make him stop. But he went on and on, inundating me with his needs, which had to be my needs, too. I was afraid. Still, my love for him made me an easy subject, willing to be cajoled, flattered, and won over to feeling I had to be wanted just for my gifts when I had them.
"And all you have to do is dream, Adrina. Just dream."
Dream, dream. That was the one thing I didn't want to do. Was he going to keep it up until I was an old lady? Or would I be able to seize hold of the first Adrina's gift and satisfy Papa? Pray God the first and best Adrina's gift would help me end up differently than she did. Why didn't he ever worry about that?
Dream, Adrina, my love, my sweet. Shakespeare wrote about it. To sleep, perchance to dream. To dream and know the truth. Come back and give me your dreams, Adrina, and make all your father's hopes for the future come true.
I stared at him sitting there on my bed. His dark eyes were no longer glittering and frightening, only pleading and full of love. How could I keep on resisting? He was my father. Fathers were supposed to know right from wrong, and I did owe him a great deal. Yes, Papa, I whispered. Just one more time. Won't just one more time be enough?
Perhaps it will be,
he said, his smile lighting up his face. Appearing happy, Papa led me by my hand down the hall to the very end room. Once there, he released me and took out a large key to unlock the door. I felt a cold draft that made me shiver. It was the first Adrina's grave breathing on me. I looked around as I always did, as if I'd never been here before. I couldn't say how many times I'd been here. This room seemed to be the one thing that filled all the holes in my memory, looming larger than any other experience. Yet each time I came, it was a shock to hear the wind chimes in the cupola begin to softly tinkle, tinkle. Even in the dark, crystal prism colors flashed behind my eyes. Perhaps I had seized hold of a memory, the memory of this all-too-familiar room. Perhaps I was beginning to benefit just from being here. If it hadn't once been her room, I'd have wanted it for my own. It was huge, with a big tester bed under the fancy canopy. There were two giant dark armoires filled with all the pretty clothes that had once been hers. Clothes they didn't want me to wear. Little shoes were lined up in neat rows, from one-year sizes to those a nine-year-old girl would wear. Some were scuffed and old, some were shiny and new. The dresses that hung above grew longer with each succeeding year. Toy shelves lined the walls full of everything any little girl could ever want. There were dolls from every foreign country dressed in native costumes. There were toy tea sets and dinner sets, picture books and storybooks, beach balls and bouncing balls, jumping ropes with fancy handles, jacks, boxes of games, puzzles and paint sets. Oh, there was nothing they hadn't bought for the first, the best, and the most perfect Adrina, far more than they'd bought for me. On those dark and brooding shelves, where the toys sat eternally grieving and waiting to be loved again, were dozens of soft, plushy pastel animals, all with dark button eyes that glinted and gleamed and seemed to follow my movements. Even baby rattles with small teeth marks were there, and worn-looking bronzed baby shoes in which she'd taken her first steps. They hadn't saved mine and had them bronzed, nor had they saved Vera's. Beneath the wide windows, covered by fussy white Priscilla curtains, was a dollhouse. A child's toy table with four chairs was set and ready for a party that was never given. Fancy rugs were scattered about to make stepping stones across the room, compartmentalizing it into rooms within a room, or mazes within a maze. Quietly as vandals, we left the doorway and stole inside that room that breathlessly awaited us. My bedroom slippers were left in the hallway outside, as were his, to show our respect to this room where the perfect daughter had once reigned. The very way Papa had taught me to bow my head and lower my eyes and speak in reverent whispers once I was in this room instilled fear in me. Expectantly, he kept his eyes on me as if waiting for her specialness to jump into my brain and fill my Swiss cheese memory with the first Adrina's gifts. He kept watching me, waiting for something to happen. But when I only turned in circles, staring at one thing and then another, he grew impatient and gestured toward the only adult-sized chair in the room, the magic rocking chair with the lacy calla lily back and the rose velvet cushion. I inched toward it reluctantly, holding my breath as I forced myself to sit. Once I had stiffly settled myself on the seat, he came to kneel at my side.
Then began his ritual of kisses rained on my hair, my face, even my arms and hands, all meant to tell me that he loved me best. He murmured endearments in my ear, his breath hot and damp, and before I could protest, he bounded to his feet and raced from the room, slamming and locking the door behind him. He'd never left me alone in here before.
"No, Papa!"
I screamed, panic in my voice, terror all around me.
"Come back! Don't make me stay in here by myself!"
"You're not alone,"
he called to me from the other side of the door.
"God is with you, and I am with you. I'll stay and wait right here, watching through the keyhole, listening, praying. Nothing but good can come from rocking in that chair. Believe that, Adrina. Nothing but good will fill your brain and replace your lost memories."
I squeezed my eyes shut and heard the wind chimes clamoring louder, much louder now.
"Sweetheart, don't cry. There's nothing to be afraid of. Hold on to your faith in me and do as I say, and your future will shine more brightly than the sun above."
Beside the chair was one of the night tables that held a lamp and a Bible. Her Bible. I snatched up the black leather-bound book and held it close against my heart. I told myself, as I'd told myself before, that there was nothing to be afraid of. The dead couldn't harm anyone. But if they couldn't, why was I so terrified? I heard Papa's soft voice outside the locked door.
"You have her gifts, Adrina. You do. Even if you don't believe, I believe. And I'm the one who knows. I'm sure the reason our previous efforts have failed is because I stayed in the room with you. It's my presence that ruins your chances at succeeding. I know now it's solitude, loneliness that makes the process begin. You've got to wash your mind free of anxieties. Feel no fear, no joy, no confusion. Expect nothing and everything will be given. Feel nothing but contentment to be alive, to be where you are and who you are. Ask nothing, receive everything. Sit there and let go of whatever makes you afraid or worried. Let contentment loosen your limbs and relax your mind. And if sleep wants to come, then let it come. Do you hear me? Are you listening? No confusion, no fear, for Papa is here."
All his words were familiar. Same old thing about not being afraid when fear was almost choking me. "Papa," I wailed for one last time. "Please don't make me."
"Oh,"
he said, heavily sighing.
"Why do I have to force you? Why can't you just believe? Lean back in the rocker. Put your head against the high back. Hold the chair arms and begin to rock. Sing if it helps to wash your mind clean of fear, of worries, of desires and emotions. Sing and sing until you become an empty pitcher. Empty pitchers have room for many, many things, but full pitchers can hold no more."
Oh yes, I'd heard this before. I knew what he was doing. He was trying to turn me into the first Adrina. Or maybe I was going to be the instrument through which he'd be able to communicate with her. I didn't want to be her. And if ever I was her, I'd hate him. Hate him. Yet he kept soothing me, cajoling me, and if I didn't want to stay in here all night, I'd have to do as he said. First, I stared around at the room again, memorizing again every detail. Little tickling sensations began to whisper. Whisper that I could be her. I was her. The dead Adrina, who was only bones in her grave. No, no. Had to think the right thoughts and give to Papa what he had to have. I told myself this was only a bedroom filled with old toys. I saw a huge spider spinning a web from doll to doll. Mama didn't like housework, even cleaning this room. Though it appeared a spotless, spick-and-span shrine, it wasn't anything but surface clean. For some reason, that made me feel better. Mama was paying what Papa called lip service to reverent cleanliness, and Aunt Elsbeth refused to clean this room. Unconsciously, I began to rock. In into my head filtered an old, almost forgotten tune. The music and lyrics played over and over again. The words lulled me, while the melody tingled my spine and slowed my pulse. Peace was coming, unbidden, to heavy my eyelids. And then vaguely, I heard my frail voice singing. Just a playroom, safe in my home. Only a playroom, safe in my home. Got no tears, no fears, and nowhere else to roam. 'Cause my papa wants me always to stay home. Safe in my playroom, safe in my home. The playroom of the first and best Adrena, the perfect Adrena who'd never given her parents the pain and trouble I delivered daily. I didn't want to sing her song, but I couldn't stop. On and on I heard the singing, trying to keep my eyes open so they could see those elephants, bears, and toy tigers on the toy shelves, all sweet and friendly looking until I glanced away. When I looked back, they were fiercely snarling. The wallpaper was faded bluish-violet, entwined with glittery silver threads to make spider webs on the walls. There were more spiders on the toys. A giant one began to weave more dolls together, and another came to rest in the eye socket of one doll that had hair somewhat the color of my own. How awful.
"Rock, Adrena, rock,"
ordered Papa.
"Make the floorboards creak. Make the gray mists come. Watch the walls dissolve. Hear the wind chimes tinkle. They'll take you back. Back to where you'll find all your memories. All the gifts that were hers. She doesn't need them where she is, but you do. So sing. Sing. Sing."
Hypnotizing, like a sing-song chant he too had to use, but he didn't know the words I was saying. Papa loves me. Yes, he does. Papa needs me. Yes, he does. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. The shiny black button eyes of the plushy animals seemed to glitter and gleam with more knowledge than I'd ever have. Little pink or red tongues appeared ready to speak and tell me secrets Papa would never reveal. High above, the wind chimes were tinkling, and contentment was coming as I rocked and rocked and became more and more tranquil. Nothing wrong with me, for sooner or later I was going to be changed in some indefinable way for the better. I grew sleepy, sleepier, unreal feeling. The orangey light from the gas lamps shivered, caught silver and gold threads in the wallpaper. All the colors in the room began to move, to sparkle like diamonds suddenly caught fire. The music of the cupola wind chimes was in my brain dancing, dancing, telling me of happy playtimes up there, slyly whispering of one terrible time up there. Who was flashing that crystal prism in my eyes? How did the wind get into the house to blow my hair when the windows were all down and locked? Were there drafts in the cupola and ghosts in the attic? What made the hair on my head move? What? Way back near the sane side of me, I wanted to believe all of this was hopeless and I'd never become an empty pitcher that would fill with everything wonderful. I truly didn't want to be that first Adrena, even if she had been more beautiful and more gifted too. Still, I rocked and sang. I couldn't stop. Contentment was on the way, making me happier. My panicky heart slowed. My pulse stopped racing. The music I heard was beautiful as I heard behind me, or ahead of me, a man's voice singing. Someone who needed me was calling. Someone who was in the future waiting, and dreamily, unquestioningly, I fuzzily saw the walls open as the molecules slowly, slowly separated, opened, and formed such grainy pores I could drift through them without difficulty. I was outside in the night that swiftly changed into day. Free! I was free of the playroom, free of my papa, free of White Fern. I was skipping merrily home from school on my own special day, and I was me. Happily, I danced along a woodsy dirt path. I'd just left school, and I didn't question or wonder about this, even knowing I'd never been to school.
Something wise was telling me I was inside the first and most wonderful Adrina, and I was going to know her as well as I knew myself. I was her, and she was me, and we were wearing a beautiful crepe de chine dress. I wore my best petticoat underneath it, the one with Irish lace and embroidered shamrocks near the hem. It was my birthday, and I was 9 years old. That meant I'd soon be 10, and 10 wasn't so far from being 11, and when I was 12, all the magic of becoming a woman was close at hand. I spun in circles to see my accordion-pleated skirt flare up to my waist. I inclined my head and spun some more to see my pretty petticoat. Suddenly, there was a noise on the path ahead. Someone giggled. Like black magic, the sky abruptly turned dark. Lightning flashed. Thunder rolled deep and ominously. I couldn't move. Like a statue of marble, I stood frozen. My heart began to beat wildly like a jungle drum. Some sixth sense woke up and screamed that something awful was soon to happen. Pain. My sixth sense was beating out shame, terror, and humiliation. Mama, Papa, help me! Don't let them hurt me! Don't let them do it! I went to Sunday school every week, didn't miss even when I had a cold. I'd earned my black Bible with my name on the cover emblazoned in gold, and I had a gold medal, too. Why hadn't the rocking chair warned me and told me how to escape? God, are you there? Are you seeing God? Do something! Do anything! Help me! Out of the bushes they jumped, three of them. Run, run fast. They'd never catch me if I ran fast enough. My legs unlocked, they ran, but not fast enough. Scream, scream loud and louder. I fought with kicks and scratches. I butted my head back against the teeth of the boy who pinned my arms behind me. God didn't hear me cry for help. Nobody heard. Scream, scream, and then scream again until I could scream no more. Just feel the shame, the humiliation, the ruthless hands that ripped and tore and violated. See the other boy who rose from behind the bushes and stood there paralyzed, staring at me with his hair pasted down on his forehead from the rain that came down hard now. See him run away. My screams brought Papa flying into the room.
"Darling, darling,"
he cried, falling to his knees so he could gather me into his arms. He cuddled me against his chest and stroked my back, my hair.
"It's all right. I'm here. I'll always be here."
"You shouldn't have, I choked, still trembling from the shock.
"What did you dream this time, my love?"
"Bad things. Same awful thing."
"Tell Papa everything. Let Papa take away the pain and shame. Do you know now why I warn you to stay out of the woods? That was your sister, Adrina, your dead sister. It doesn't have to happen to you. You're letting that scene into your head when all I want is for you to travel beyond the woods and take for yourself all the specialness she used to have. Did you see how happy she could be? How joyful and vibrant? Did you see how wonderful it used to be for her when she stayed out of the woods? That's what I want for you. Oh, my sweet Adrina,"
he whispered with his face buried deep in my hair.
"It won't always be that way. Someday, when you sit down to rock and sing, you'll bypass the woods, forget the boys, and find the beauty of being alive. Once you do, all the memories you've forgotten, the good things will come flooding back and make you whole again."
He was telling me, with good intentions, that I wasn't whole now. And if that were so, what was I? Crazy?
"Tomorrow night we'll do this again. I don't think it was as bad this time as before. This time you pulled out of it and came back to me."
I knew I had to save myself from this room and this chair. Somehow I had to convince him I had gone on beyond the woods and had already found the gifts the first Adrina no longer needed. Tenderly he tucked me into bed, and on his knees he said a prayer to send me safely into sweet dreams, asking the angels on high to protect me through the night.
He kissed my cheek and said he loved me, and even as he closed the door behind him, I was wondering how I could convince him not to make me go to that room and sit in that chair again. How could I hate what he did to me and love the idea of being what he wanted? How did I preserve me when he was trying to turn me into her? For hours, I lay on my back, staring up at the ceiling, trying to find my past and all the fancy swirls in the overhead plaster. Papa had given me many clues as to what would make him happiest. Papa wanted lots and lots of money for himself, for Mama, for me too. He wanted to fix up this house and make it like new again. He had to fulfill all the promises he'd made to Lucetta Lana Whitefern, the heiress every worthy man on the Lower East Coast had wanted until she married him. What a catch my mother had been. If only she hadn't given birth to two Adrenas. Tuesday Tea Time. Christmas came and went, but I hardly remembered anything but a princess doll that had shown up under the tree, making Vera jealous, even though she often insisted she was much too old to play with dolls. It scared me the way time moved along so swiftly, so that even before I knew what was happening, spring was on its way. Days were falling into the holes in my memory. Vera liked to torment me by saying that anyone who couldn't keep track of time was insane. Today was Tuesday, and Aunt Mercy Marie would visit again, even though it seemed to me only yesterday that Mercy Marie had been brought out for tea time. Papa was taking his time about leaving this Tuesday morning. He sat at the kitchen table expounding on life and all its complexities while Vera and my aunt consumed pancakes as if they would never eat again. Soberly, my mother was preparing the canapés and other treats for tea time.
"They were the best of times. They were the worst of times,"
began my papa, who loved to say that phrase over and over again. It seemed to grate on my mother's nerves as much as it did on mine. He made it an awesomely fearsome thing to even think beyond tomorrow. On and on he went, making his time to be young seem so much better than any time I was likely to know. Life had been perfect when Papa was a boy. Back then, people had been nicer. Houses had been constructed to last forever and not fall apart as they did nowadays. Dogs, too, had been better when he was a boy. Really reliable, sure to bring back every hurled stick. Even the weather was better, not so hot in the summers, nor so cold in the winters, unless there was a blizzard. No blizzard now had a chance of equaling the freezing ferocity of the blizzards Papa had to trudge home from school in.
20 miles,
he boasted.
"Through the wind and snow, through sleet and rain, through the hail and ice, nothing kept me home. Even when I had pneumonia. When I was in high school on the football team and broke my leg, that didn't keep me from walking to school every day. I was hardy, determined to be well-educated, to be the best there was."
Mama slammed down a dish so hard it cracked.
"Damien, stop exaggerating."
Her voice was harsh, impatient.
"Can't you see what false notions you plant in your daughter's mind?" "What other kind of notions have either one of you ever planted?"
asked Aunt Elspeth sourly.
"If Adrena grows up to be normal, it will be a miracle."
"Amen to that," contributed Vera. She grinned at me and then stuck out her tongue. Papa didn't notice. He was too busy shouting at my aunt.
"Normal? What is normal? In my opinion, normal is only ordinary, mediocre. Life belongs to the rare, exceptional individual who dares to be different."
"Damien, will you please stop expounding on your ideas to a child too young to understand that you are not an authority on anything except how to run your mouth all day long?"
"Silence!"
bellowed Papa.
"I won't have my wife ridiculing me in front of my only child. Lucky, apologize immediately."
Why was Aunt Elspeth smirking? It was my secret belief that my aunt loved to hear my parents argue. Vera made some gagging noise and then, with a great deal of difficulty, rose to her feet and limped toward the front hall. Soon she'd be boarding the school bus I'd sell my soul to ride on like every other child who wasn't as special as I was. Instead, I had to stay home, lonely for playmates, with the kind of adults who filled my head with hodgepodge notions and then stirred them up with a witch's stick of contradictions. No wonder I didn't know who I was or which day of the week, month, or even year it was. I didn't have any best or worst times. I lived, it seemed to me, in a theater, with the exception being the actors on stage were my family members, and I too had a role to play. Only I didn't know what it was. All of a sudden, for no reason at all, I was looking around the kitchen and remembering a large orange cat who used to sleep near the old cast iron stove. "I wish Tweedledee would come home," I said wistfully. "I'm even lonelier since my cat went away." Papa jolted. Mama stared at me.
"Why, Tweedledee has been gone for a long, long time, Adrina."
Her voice sounded strained, worried. "Oh, yes," I said quickly. "I know that, but I want him to come home. Papa, you didn't take him to the city pound, did you? You wouldn't put my cat to sleep, would you, just because he makes you sneeze?" He threw me a worried look, then forced a smile.
"No, Adrina. I do the best I can to cater to all your needs, and if that cat had wanted to stay and make me sneeze myself to death, I would have suffered on in silence for your sake." "Suffered, but not in silence,"
muttered my aunt. I watched my parents embrace and kiss before Papa headed for the garage.
"Have a good time at your tea party,"
he called back to Mama.
"Though I wish to heaven you'd let Mercy Marie stay dead. What we need is someone to live in that empty cottage we own. Then you'd have a nice neighbor woman to invite to your teas."
"Damien," called Mama sweetly, "you go out and have your fun, don't you? Since we're held captives here, at least let Ellie and me have ours." He grunted and said no more, and soon I was at the front windows watching him drive away. His hand lifted in a salute before he drove out of sight. I didn't want him to go. I hated Tuesday tea time. Tea time was supposed to begin at 4, but since Vera had started playing hooky to escape her last class in order to reach home by 4, tea time had been moved up to 3 o'clock. Wearing my best clothes, I sat ready and waiting for the ritual to begin. I was required to be there as part of my social education, and if Vera was incapacitated enough to stay home legitimately, then she was invited to the parties, too. I often thought Vera broke her bones just so she could stay home and hear what went on in our best front salon. My tension built as I waited for Mama and my aunt to show up. First came Mama, dressed in her prettiest afternoon gown, a soft flowing wool crepe of a pretty coral color, with piping of violet to match her eye color. She wore a pearl choker and earrings with real diamonds and pearls to match the choker. It was heirloom white fern jewelry she'd told me many times would be mine one day. Her magnificent hair was swept up high, but a few loose curls dangled down to take away the severity and make her look elegant. Next came my aunt in her best outfit, a dark navy blue suit with a tailored white blouse. As always, she wore her dark, glossy hair in a figure-eight knot low on the back of her neck. Tiny diamond studs were in her ears, and on her little finger she wore a ruby-class ring. She looked very schoolmarmish.
"Ellie, will you let Mercy Marie in?" said Mama sweetly.
Tuesday was the only day my mother was allowed to call her sister by her nickname. Only Papa could call my Aunt Ellie any time he chose.
"Oh, dear, you are late," said Aunt Elsbeth,
getting up to lift the piano lid and take from underneath the heavy silver frame that enclosed the photograph of a fat woman with a very sweet face.
"Really, Mercy Marie, we expect you to arrive on time. You've always had the annoying habit of arriving late. To make an impression, I suppose. But, dear, you'd make an impression even if you arrived early."
Mama giggled as my aunt sat down and primly folded her hands in her lap.
"The piano isn't too hard for you, dear, is it? But it is sturdy enough, I hope."
Again, Mama giggled, making me squirm uneasily, for I knew the worst was yet to come.
"Yes, Mercy Marie, we do understand why you're always tardy. Running away from those passionate savages must be very exhausting. But you really should know it's been rumored about that you were cooked in a pot by a cannibal chief and eaten for dinner. Lucietta and I are delighted to see that was only a malicious rumor."
Carefully, she crossed her legs and stared at that portrait on the piano, placed just where music sheets were usually stacked. It was part of Mama's role to get up and light the candles in the crystal candelabra while the fire snapped and crackled and the gas lamps flickered and made the crystal prisms on the chandeliers catch colors and dart crazily about the room.
"Elsbeth, my dear, my darling,"
said my mother for the dead woman who had to participate, even if her ghost was often rebellious.
"Is that the only suit you own? You wore it last week and the week before. And your hair, good God, why don't you change that hairstyle? It makes you look 60.
Always, Mama's voice was sickeningly sweet when she spoke for Aunt Mercy Marie.
"I like my hairstyle,"
said my aunt primly, watching my mother roll in the tea wagon loaded down with all the goodies Mom had prepared earlier.
"At least I don't try to look like a pampered mistress who spends all her time trying to please an egotistical sex maniac. Of course, I realize that's the only kind of man there is. That is exactly why I chose to stay single."
"I'm sure that's the only reason," said my mother in her own voice. Then she spoke for the photograph on the piano.
"But, Ellie, I remember a time when you were madly in love with an egotistical maniac. In love enough to go to bed with him and have his child. Too bad he only used you to satisfy his lust. Too bad he never fell in love with you."
"Oh, him?"
said my aunt, snorting her disgust.
"He was just a passing fancy. His animal magnetism drew me to him momentarily, but I had sense enough to forget him and move on to better things. I know he found another immediately. All men are alike. Selfish, cruel, demanding. I know now he would have made the worst possible husband."
"Too bad you couldn't have found a wonderful man like Lucky's handsome Damien," said that sweet voice from the piano as my mother sat down to nibble on a dainty sandwich. I stared at the picture of a woman I didn't remember ever meeting, though Mama said I had known her when I was 4. She appeared to be very wealthy. Diamonds hung from her ears, neck, studded her fingers. The fur trimming on her suit collar made her face seem to sit on her shoulders. Often, I imagined that if she rose, she'd have fur about long, full sleeves and rimming the edge of her skirt, like a medieval queen. Mercy Marie had traveled all the way to Africa in hopes of salvaging a few heathen souls and converting them to Christianity. Now she was part of the heathens, eaten, hopefully, after she was killed and cooked. According to everything I'd learned from attending these tea times, Aunt Mercy Marie once had a ridiculous fondness for cucumber and lettuce sandwiches made with the thinnest possible cheese bread. In order to do this, my mother had to bake the bread, trim off the crust, and flatten the bread with her rolling pin. The bread was then cut with cookie cutters into fancy shapes.
"Really, Mercy Marie," said my aunt in her harsh way, "ham, cheese, chicken, or tuna is not as tacky as you think. We eat food like that all the time, don't we, Lucietta?"
Mama scowled. I hated to hear what she'd say next, something cruel and biting.
"If Mercy Marie adores dainty cucumber and lettuce sandwiches, Ellie, why don't you let her eat a few instead of hogging them all for yourself? Don't be such a pig. Learn to share."
"Lucietta, darling,"
spoke up the shrill voice from the piano, this time donated by my aunt.
"Please show your older sister the respect due her. You give her such tiny portions at mealtimes, she has to make up for your stinginess by eating the sandwiches I adore."
"Oh, Mercy, you are such a dear, so gracious. Of course I should know my sister's appetite can never be satisfied. A bottomless pit could hold no more than Ellie's stomach. Perhaps she tries to fill the great emptiness of her life with food. Perhaps for her it replaces love." On and on went the memorial tea time, while the perfumed candles burned and the fire spat red sparks, and Aunt Ellie consumed all the sandwiches, even those with chicken liver pate, which I liked very much, and so did Vera. I nibbled on a sandwich I hated. This kind always tasted like Aunt Mercy Marie might have. Damp, grassy, and soggy.
"Really, Lucietta?"
said Aunt Elsbeth, using the voice of the dear departed, casting me a grievous look for so obviously disliking what Mercy Marie must have loved most.
You should do something about that child's appetite. She's nothing but skin and bones and huge haunted eyes, and that ridiculous mop of hair. Why does she look so spooked? From the looks of her, some dry wind could blow her away, if she doesn't lose her mind first. Lucietta, what are you doing to that child?
About this time, I heard the squeak of the side door opening, and in a few seconds, Vera crawled into the room. She hid herself behind a potted fern so our mothers wouldn't see her, and put her finger to her lips when I looked her way. She had with her a huge medical encyclopedia that had cardboard front pieces made of both the female and the male body, without clothes on. I cringed. Behind me, Vera giggled. I shrank into that small hiding place in my brain where I could feel safe and unafraid. But that place felt like a cage. I always felt caged when Aunt Mercy Marie's spiteful ghost came to our front salon. She was dead and unreal, but somehow or other, she still made me feel like a shadow without substance. Not real in the same way other girls were real. My hand fluttered nervously to feel my haunted eyes, to touch my gaunt cheeks, for sooner or later she'd get around to mentioning those things too.
"Mercy," spoke my mother chastisingly, "how can you be so insensitive in front of my daughter?"
She stood, looking tall and willowy in her soft, flowing dress. I stared at that dress, confused. Surely she'd walked into this room in something coral-colored. How had it changed colors? Was it the light from the windows making it seem violet, green, and blue? My head began to ache. Was it summer, spring, winter, or fall? I wanted to run to the windows and check the trees. Only they didn't lie. Other things were said that I tried not to hear, and then Mama strode over to the piano and sat down to play all the hymns that Aunt Mercy Marie liked to sing. The minute my mother sat on her piano bench, something miraculous happened. She assumed a stage presence as if an audience of thousands would soon be applauding. Her long, elegant fingers hovered over the keys dramatically. Then down they came, banging out a commanding chord to demand your attention. "Rock of Ages," she played, and then she was singing so beautifully and sadly I wanted to cry. My aunt began to sing too, but I couldn't join in. Something inside me was screaming, screaming. All this was false. God wasn't up there. He didn't come when you needed him. He never had, and he never would. Mama saw my tears and abruptly changed pace. This time her hymn was played in a rock style that bounced through the room. "Won't you come to the church in the wildwood? Won't you come to the church in the vale?" she sang, rocking from side to side, making her breasts jiggle. My aunt began to eat cake again. Discouraged, my mother left the piano and sat on the sofa. "Mama," I asked in a small voice, "what's a veil?"
"Lucietta, why don't you teach your child something of value?" asked that merciless voice on the piano.
When my head whipped around, trying to catch Aunt Elspeth talking, she was sipping hot tea, which I knew was heavily laced with bourbon, just as Mama's tea was. Maybe it was the liquor that made them so cruel. I didn't know if they had liked Aunt Mercy Marie when she was alive, or if they had despised her. I knew they liked to mock the way they thought she'd been killed, as if they couldn't quite believe Papa, who had explained to me more than once that Aunt Mercy Marie might very well be alive and the wife of some African chieftain.
"Fat women are prized in many primitive societies,"
he told me.
"She just disappeared 2 weeks after she arrived there to do her missionary work. Don't believe everything you hear, Adrina."
That was my worst problem. What to believe and what not to believe. Giggling, Mama poured a bit more tea into my aunt's cup and some into her own, and then she picked up a crystal bottle labeled bourbon and filled the two cups. Then Mama spotted Vera.
"Vera,"
she said,
"would you like a cup of hot tea?"
Of course Vera did, but she scowled when no bourbon was added.
"What are you doing home from school so early?"
shot out my aunt. "The teachers had a meeting and let all the students off earlier than usual," said Vera quickly.
"Vera, be truthful in the presence of the living dead,"
giggled my mother, almost drunk by this time. Vera and I exchanged glances. This was one of the only times we could really communicate, when we both felt strange and baffled.
"What do you do for amusement, Ellie?"
asked my mother in that high-pitched, sugary voice she used for Aunt Mercy Marie. "Certainly you must get bored, too, once in a while, living way out in the sticks, having no friends."